The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab episode number 644 for Sunday, February 12th, 2017. Folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, your tips, your cool stuff found. We share it all. We try to answer your questions. Really, what we try to do is learn four new things each and every time we get together. Sponsors for this episode include GoDaddy, GoDaddy.com, where coupon code MGG30, that's MGG30, saves you 30%, saves me 30%. On new purchases. We'll talk about that in a minute. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in frozen, precipitation-laden Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
Yeah. So, I had a crazy amount of travel this week, John, and for the most part, I would love to say that I scheduled it brilliantly around these you know, basically three blizzards that we had, or a snowstorm and two blizzards. But it was just dumb luck, really. I took the train to Boston on Tuesday for a multi-day Sonos kind of press event. They had some stuff to talk to us about that's going on over there, which was really nice. But I took the train down because it was snowing on Tuesday, and I thought, well, I don't want to drive into Boston with that. So I took the train in, and that was fine. And then I was supposed to come back Thursday, but we had a blizzard there. So I stayed in Boston for the blizzard on Thursday and then flew to Dallas Friday, spoke in Dallas Saturday, flew back Saturday. Now we're having a blizzard on Sunday while we're recording this. So it's but all my flights are on time. Everything was golden. You know, it was all good. But, I spoke about mesh networks. That was the title of my talk, was mesh networks yesterday down in Dallas. It was a great user group down there. We actually spent 3 hours talking about routers. Most of it was, you know, their questions and us kind of having a roundtable discussion. Big roundtable, but, you know, it wasn't at a roundtable.
Was it actually... Oh.
No, there was no table. I was standing in front of a group of people.
Okay. You're talking figuratively.
Figuratively. That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. But it was a good discussion. And I know we've promised to talk about a couple of things, and that's the Linksys Velop and, of course, the Google Wi-Fi. I'm still waiting for some answers from both of those companies, believe it or not. The short version is... Velop really interests me because of the hardware, because it's got tri-band and all that stuff. They have done some weird things to limit their software. And that's kind of okay. Every vendor seems to do that when they launch, because they want to get the hardware out and then, give a limited feature set in the software that gets people up and running. And then over time can kind of roll out new software features. The one problem, and that's fine. I don't really hold that against them necessarily, but I'm having really inconsistent speed results, and it doesn't sound like I'm alone based on other people that I've talked to and some forum posts that I've read. So I'm hoping that a software update can resolve that kind of stuff, or maybe there's just something else going on. So I want to, at this point I would say, you know, hold off on the Velop just because of that. But hopefully in the next week or so, we can talk a little more in detail about that, because that product, it's kind of like the Netgear Orbi, although the Orbi doesn't have any speed problems. But in terms of, you know, the tri-band hardware, that's very interesting. So there's that one. The Google Wi-Fi, similarly, I'm waiting for some answers specifically about QoS from them as to whether or not they support it. It certainly doesn't seem like it supports it. But I want to know that for certain before we talk more in depth about it. But, you know, at that price, Google Wi-Fi is certainly a compelling thing. And the speeds are, you know, I would say on par with what you get with Eero with current software from them. So pretty good stuff so far. So that's the short of it. Certainly not the long of it. But there you go. So let's... anything to add or any questions about that, John, before we move on to our fill here?
No, I'm still happy with the old Eero.
Yeah.
They did a recent software update, makes the interface... Now they repositioned a lot of the data, and I think it's nice. So they haven't released any firmware updates.
Yeah,
so
they did. 2.2 just came out the other day.
Oh,
don't update now. Yeah, yeah, and that
of course not.
Right, that actually makes some significant changes. They say I haven't fully tested with it yet, but to the efficiency of the mesh and the handoff between devices. So it should. That should help actually quite a bit.
Hey, look at that. It says update available.
Oh, no.
Okay, that's nice. We'll
do it later.
I'm surprised I didn't get a notification. I would have liked to have gotten a notification. Oh, well.
There's whatever. No notification. It just takes care of it for you when the time is right. So, yeah, I just happened to notice it in the hotel room the other night while I was taking some screenshots for my presentation yesterday. And I was like, hey, there's the update. So I took the screenshots before I triggered the remote update of the Eero because, you know, I wanted to get my screenshots. So all my screenshots had your little update available thing. But the Eero is still atop my list of mesh recommendations. The Synology RT2600 AC is atop my list of standalone router recommendations. And I think I wound up convincing people to buy both of those yesterday. So, all right. Let's move on to Phil, change gears entirely. And Phil says, I recall a few shows back, you recommended a battery pack for iOS devices from Monoprice. He says, I also found, and he found some on Monoprice. And he says, I also found some off-brand one on Amazon. I was hoping to get your feedback on to which one you would prefer and why. So here's the thing, Phil and everyone. This is a hard question to answer, but maybe it's not that hard. I would tend to lean towards the Monoprice stuff over some, you know, off brand on Amazon, simply because I've had good experience with Monoprice and I have no experience with off brand on Amazon batteries. But it's entirely possible that they're both made in the same factory and might even be, you know, the same battery at their core. When I look at an external battery, you know, something for the iPhone, something for the iPad, and we all need these from time to time, or many of us need these, maybe not all of us, but I certainly spent my share of time using them over the last few days while traveling. I obviously look at capacity, how much it's supposed to deliver, and not all batteries deliver what they're supposed to deliver. And I also look at form factor. You know, does it fit the way I like to do it? Is it something I would want to keep in my pocket with my phone? If so, how does that work? I look at how many ports it has, if that matters. Again, all of that stuff. I make sure I know whether some or all of the ports on the battery pack can charge an iOS device at 2 amps instead of 1 amp. Some batteries can do 2 amps only for Android. Some are smart enough to be able to do both iOS and Android and you know, all of that. So you've got to just be aware and make sure you're getting something if you want it to be able to charge faster than the 1 amp. And most of your devices can accept a charge faster than 1 amp. Not everybody can go up to 2, but you can certainly go faster. So, you know, take a look at that. That's one of the things I look at. Both of the ones that, you know, and I researched the ones that Phil sent in and they all do that. The Monoprice stuff does it. But, part of the reason it's hard for me to weigh in on this is I don't think I've personally purchased a battery pack in a very, very long time. Actually, I say that's not true. Before we went to Europe, I bought a Tilt battery pack to use for my it was a battery case to use for my iPhone SE because I didn't have a good one for the iPhone 5, you know, /5S/SE sized phone. So I bought one personally, you know, with my own little money at Amazon. And I chose Tilt because I trust them. But, you know, and here's the deal, you know, having my pick of pretty much mostly everything that's sent to me, I tend to go with the brands that I know, which includes Tilt, as I mentioned. Monoprice is another one I'm happy to use, and Anchor. It's basically, you know, those are the three that I tend to really trust because we're talking about plugging in a device to charge your iPhone or your iPad. And your iPhone and your iPad cost you, you know, somewhere close to $1,000, right? Certainly north of 500. And saving 10 bucks on a battery pack sounds kind of dangerous to me. And, you know, as we learned from you, John, back in the spring, plug the wrong thing into your iOS device and it will no longer charge from any source anymore. And it's effectively useless. So, you know, I'm all about being frugal. And I know it may not seem like that based on some of the recommendations I give here. But I certainly am. I don't like to spend money unnecessarily. But we're talking 10 bucks here to use something that you can trust to plug into your phone. And so, you know, that's why I bought the Tilt battery pack instead of, you know, whatever, Joe Schmo's battery pack. Joe Schmo's a really nice guy. I've known him for years. He makes terrible battery packs, though, so I don't buy his. So that's my thoughts on it. You know, your mileage may vary. What you stuff that you trust that's different from that, John?
Absolutely. So one, to the subject of chargers blowing up your device, the company looks like they no longer make chargers, and for good reason.
Good.
Because it was a piece of garbage. The company, they still exist, Mota, M-O-T-A, and it blew up my device, and their customer service was horrible. They the best they could do is they said, oh, would you like another one? And it's like, yeah, boy, sign me up for that, to have another one to
yeah,
blow
that's
up
what
more
you
devices.
Want. Yeah, that's right.
I was like, how about you pay for the device that your faulty design? And they're like, no, we're not going to do that. I'm like, eh. So I learned a valuable lesson. It was I got it through Groupon. You know, it was inexpensive. It was like under $10. And it worked for a while. And then all of a sudden it went rogue. And
yeah. And that's what I'm saying. Everything. It's like, you know, how much is it worth saving? Clearly, in your case, it wasn't worth saving 10 bucks.
Yeah, but it was, you know. That they seem to be a reputable vendor, but again, it looks like they exited that market. Now they make drones, and
okay.
I don't know if I'd want to get one of their drones. But to your recommendations, so battery pack. So I'm going to make some recommendations. So one, I'm going to tweak what you said. You said 2.1 amps.
I said actually, two in a very general sense. I didn't even say 2.1.
Okay. So yeah. Some of the things I'm going to mention here actually will go up to 2.4. Which
okay.
Many iOS devices can handle, and if you can get that,
iPads.
You want that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, even my iPhone 7 will accept 2400.
It won't
I've
charge
seen it.
That fast.
Yes, it does. We'll talk further. There's a utility that I have that indicates that the phone is in fact accepting a charge at 2.4. So, but we'll talk about it a little later.
But that doesn't. Have you tested it with your little meter?
I can, but the utility that I have on the phone that tells what current is coming in to charge it has always been accurate. So I have no reason to question it.
Well, I do, because with a formula okay. that we've heard about batteries is that it's essentially like 1C is the formula, right? So if your battery is it's amps to 1,000 milliamp hours. Right. So if your phone battery is capable, it holds 1,000 milliamp hours of a charge at full capacity, then it can only safely charge at 1 amp. So in order to safely charge at 2.4 amps by that formula, your phone battery would need to be 2,400 milliamp hours or larger, which, of course, an iPad is. But I don't believe your phone is. I think your phone is like 1,700. So that's why I'm asking if you put a meter on it and actually test it to see how much current is actually passing to the phone battery.
I'll put the meter on to verify.
Okay.
But all I'm saying is that the utility I have that tells the level of
what
current.
What is this mysterious utility? What's the name of it?
It's called battery percentage.
Okay. And my guess is it's wrong, because I have an iPhone 7 as well.
Okay.
And I've put a meter on it, and it tends to follow that formula, that 1C formula.
Okay. Fair enough. I believe what the utility is saying, but I'll verify with my my USB charger.
Yeah,
but back to the battery packs that we're talking about here. So I have some criteria. So one, a number of these do offer 2.4 amp charging. The first one I'm going to mention here. Well, actually, let me mention the oldest one. So you and I actually both received this at a at a recent show, and I think it's really cool. So the other criteria I like is if you can get a battery pack that has a wall plug, that's a nice feature because then you don't have to carry around a cable in order to give it a boost. You just plug it into the wall. The one that I like here, and actually I walk the talk, is that I actually brought it with me CES because I needed a good charger here. And this is the MyCharge Amprong Plus.
There you go.
And I believe it's about 6,000. So the capacity is 6,700 milliamp hours. It can do 2.4 amp output on both ports. And the retail is $50 and has two USB ports. So you could actually charge two devices at once. So I think that's a really nice one.
That's cool.
The second one here is Ventev. Also another one. So, you know,
I would trust both of these brands that you've mentioned so far, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. And Ventev makes one that's very similar. It's called the PowerCell 6000 Plus. It can also do, now it can do 1 amp and 2.1. So one of the ports is 1 amp, one is 2.1, but it also has about, well, as the name implies, 6,000, you know, milliamp hours worth of charge. And that one looks to retail for $60. So they're a little bulky, but you can still carry them in a computer bag and stuff like that. And then the last one that I'll mention, just because I like the form factor, is the Thinium Recharge Plus. And this one also plugs into the wall. It's smaller capacity. I think it's about 3,000 milliamp hours. Let's see. Yeah, it's about $70 here. And actually, I have the Recharge regular version. So they have one that provides 2 amps here. The one that they sent me to a review actually only does 1 amp output. But it's nice because it's thin, has a wall plug, has a lightning connector, has a USB connector. The other two that I mentioned just have USB plugs, so you're going to need to provide a lightning cable.
Sure.
This actually has the lightning port built in.
One of the ones I like to travel with is one of the brands I mentioned, Tilt. And it's got... they've got various sizes, but it's about the one I use is about the same form factor as an iPhone, but it has its own lightning cable right in it. So you can just pop it right off the bottom and plug it right into the phone. It's a short little cable. So you can basically piggyback your phone with it. It doesn't actually, you know, attach to your phone other than the cable, but it's a right angle cable, which is great if you need to rest your phone and mess with it while it's being charged, which is something I really like. So it's cool stuff. All right. So hopefully that helps you folks decide what batteries to get for yourselves. None of these are going to break the bank, by the way. But like I said, you know, get something that either you think is reputable or that we do. And hopefully, you know, it protects your phone and all of that. All right. Speaking of protecting your phone, let's go to Adam here. He says, a couple of years ago, you guys spoke a bunch of times about the merits of using a tempered glass screen protector on your mobile devices. I took your device and got one for my iPhone and for my iPad mini. A couple of weeks ago, I dropped my iPad mini on a ceramic tile floor. Sure enough, the screen was cracked, or so it appeared. I removed the glass screen protector, and lo and behold, the iPad screen underneath was in perfect condition. The first thought that went through my head was, thanks, Dave and John. It turns out I didn't get caught after all. Keep up the good work. Well, thanks, Adam. I'm glad that that worked for you. I will say I have seen a phone screen crack even with a tempered glass protector. If you hit it, you know, I was going to say just the right way, but really it's more just the wrong way on the corner. You can still crack one. My son has done it. But by and large, the tempered glass protectors do a great job of protecting while still feeling like glass, because they are. And the really good news is that you can get these tempered glass protectors for a 3-pack is less than $10. And my current favorite that I think everybody should get, and I'll explain why, is from, I can't even think of the name of the company. I gotta find the link that I put here. It is on Amazon, $8.99. It's from a company called Fox Novo, FOXNOVO. This is currently what I have on my phone. But it's not just about the tempered glass. This comes with, I'll call it an applicator. Really what it is it's a guide. You take your phone out of its case and you slide this little thing onto the bottom of the phone that goes up maybe, you know, 25% of the phone. It's this little orange bracket. And what it does is it creates a perfect little pocket for you to drop the bottom of this glass screen protector in. So you wipe your phone clean, you slide this thing on there, and then you just kind of drop the glass in, and it perfectly aligns the thing on your phone. So you don't have to think about it. You don't have to mess with it. You just put it on. And then my advice is push in the middle so that you're pushing the air out. If you start pushing around the edges, you might trap a bubble in. If you do, just lift up one edge that's closest to where the bubble is, and you can usually get the bubble out without letting dust in. But for $8.99 for a 3-pack with the applicator tool, I recommend, if you, in our house, we have both regular and plus size phones. So I bought one of each, and now I have the applicator for all, you know, future applications, even if I'm not buying Fox Novo's glass. So, but $8.99 for a 3-pack is cheap with or without the applicator. So it's a pretty good deal. So there you go. That's my favorite on those. Do you have any thoughts on that, John?
Nice. I think I got, I've honestly never used them. I think the most recent that I got, and fortunately I've never had a drop event that shattered the screen. I've been fortunate in the, sure, in that respect. But I do remember getting some from, I think, OtterBox.
Had okay. Some. Yeah. They're so expensive though. I mean, like we're talking not quite an order of magnitude. Well, yeah, actually it would be an order of magnitude. Now the difference is, like, OtterBox's tempered glass protectors come with a lifetime warranty. But I mean, you know, at $8.99 for a 3-pack, it's going to take a long time to get up to whatever the $50 is that they want to charge for this thing. So, you know, love those guys. They make some great products. Otherwise, I'm sure their glass screen protectors are fantastic, but they're also fantastically priced in a way that favors them. So
that's fantastic.
That's fantastic. Yeah. 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 So I don't know. I would, I mean, it, you know, again, it's not that I wouldn't recommend them. I would happily recommend them. I've used them and they're fine. They're just massively overpriced. So, you know, that's where we go with it. Anything else on that, that front, John? You gotta try some of these Fox Novo things, man. This little applicator is killer. I love it. It's good stuff.
Yeah, I just don't want to spoil the pristine. I don't know.
It's really thin. I mean, I'll tell you, I used to use the plastic stuff because I wanted to keep my screen from being scratched, but I hated it. It, you know, it got all, it was, it just felt bad and all of that. These glass ones, man, they feel great. They're really thin. They fit with pretty much every case I've used. So I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, different strokes for different folks.
Highly recommend you try it. All right.
Okay. Well, you know how things go with me listening to what
I
you
do.
Say.
I say every now and then something
about
like
50-50.
You know, yeah, something.
Or 80-20.
That's generous. Yeah. 20-80 seems like more like it. All right. Let's go to, why don't you take us to Bobby, John?
I'm going to take us to Bobby. So Bobby has a great question, and I have an answer. No, I have two answers. And Bobby says, good evening. Well, it's not, it will be eventually. And here's what he has to say. At work,
I appreciate your optimism, John.
I support about 175 iPhones and have people come to me from time to time explaining how they think their iPhone battery is bad. Okay, I like the way he put that.
Yeah.
Now, I know I can send them to the Apple Store for a battery test. However, I would like to be able to test the battery myself before sending them to the Apple Store. Would either of you happen to know of any iPhone battery testing software I could purchase? Thank you. All right, Bobby. Well, the thing is, no and yes. So the thing is, no, I don't have any you can purchase, because the two things I'm going to tell you about are free, though I believe you can donate to them or buy a premium version. So the first one, Dave, and you and I have used this, is Coconut Battery.
For the Mac, right?
Correct.
Yeah,
so
okay.
Coconut Battery is a utility for the Mac that can tell you what's going down with the battery in your Mac. But it also has this not quite hidden, maybe not fully advertised feature, where it also has a screen where if you plug an iOS device in and you click on the little tab saying, tell me about my iOS device, it'll say, hey, here's what's happening with your iOS device. Here's the maximum capacity of the battery. Here's the current capacity. And that should give you a very basic feel for the health of the battery and the device, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, it's not running a test per se, but it is giving you, it's telling you. And I think the thing is, when people complain that their battery is not working right, short of the thing shutting down, that's a whole different story. But, you know, you're going to lose capacity over time. And at some point you may have to replace the battery, either have Apple do it or, you know, if you're handy, you may be able to do it yourself. But this will tell you at what state your battery is at versus the original design capacity.
Yeah. Yeah. It's handy. It's good. It, like you said, it's good that way, you know.
Okay. And the second one I'm going to mention, now this is the software that I erroneously faulted for destroying my device, but I now have come to rely on it and love it. And it's called Battery Percentage. And it shows you, and this is something you install on your iOS device. And there's a free version and a pro version. The pro version will get rid of ads. But it will tell you all sorts of things about the battery in the iOS device. Similarly, it'll tell you the maximum capacity, the current capacity. It'll tell you the voltage of the battery, the temperature. And then if you plug in a charger, Dave, it'll tell you the source, whether it's a, you know, USB charger or a computer or something, the amperage of the charge. And as we just discussed, some things will be 1 amp. I've seen some at 2.1 and I've seen some at 2.4. Now, whether it's really happening, I'll verify that, Dave. I understand your point. And then
What it might be telling you, and I wish I had my meter here to test, because I tried this while we were talking here, and it says the amperage. Now, I'm plugged into a CalDigit Thunderbolt 3 dock that I have on the iMac here in the studio, largely because this 2011 iMac doesn't have USB 3 ports. So Thunderbolt dock, not Thunderbolt 3 dock. My apologies. It's CalDigit Thunderbolt dock that has USB 3 because this computer doesn't. But it also has one of these ports on the front, so I use it to charge occasionally. And it says that it's a USB charger, which is interesting. It doesn't think it's a computer. And it says the amperage is 1,500 milliamps. Now, it also says that my phone is 1960 milliamp hours is its maximum capacity, and it says my battery health is perfect. The amperage of the charger is 1,500 milliamps. Now, that may be the maximum amperage of the charger as opposed to what it's actually currently charging at. And really, the best way to test that would be to plug in a phone that's at 100%, because that amperage should change as the phone approaches 100%. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't, then that tells us that it's just getting the maximum that the charger can send you as opposed to what the phone is choosing to accept, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Or maybe saying, so for example, I tried this with the charger that came with my iPad.
Yeah.
Which is a 12 watt, 2.4 amp charger. And
right.
When I plug that into my iPhone 7, it says, oh yeah, the thing that I'm talking to can provide. So maybe it's telling what is being provided, what it can provide.
Yeah, the maximum
capacity. Actually being provided.
That would make sense. Yeah, yeah.
So those are my two recommendations.
Cool.
One for the Mac, one for the iOS device, and that will, that's I think the best you're going to get. The Apple, if you bring it to the Genius Bar, their utility may do more than this.
Oh, that would make sense. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't know what I don't know if they exercise it or maybe there are other signals that they read. So there
sure.
you go. That's the answer.
Yeah, good stuff. Fun. I don't have anything else. The coconut battery would have been my thing. I had forgotten about battery percentage. How could I ever forget? But I had forgotten about it.
Oh, how could I forget?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But,
and there's a plethora of other utilities. A lot of general utilities have things that'll tell you various things about the battery, but these are the ones that I use.
Yeah.
And you should use, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, I like this one. I mean, it's nice to be able to get this data without having to plug into my Mac and launch Coconut Battery. So that's handy stuff. And it's nice to know that it's free. So like Bobby, if you have somebody come to you that's looking to you for some support and says, I think my iPhone battery is bad, you can very, very quickly look and say, hey, no. Now, my question for you is, I tend to trust Coconut Battery to give me an accurate reading of my battery health. In your experience, does the number you get from whatever this thing's called, battery percentage, match what Coconut Battery tells you from the Mac side of things?
Yes.
Okay, great. That's good to know. Sweet. So we can trust this to, because right now it's telling me mine's perfect, you know, that it's 1960 out of 1960. So that's, you know, the skeptical part of me says, it's just a made up number. They're just telling me that, but maybe not. So it's, in fact, it doesn't sound like maybe not. It sounds like definitely not based on your experience. So that's good. All right. I want to talk about GoDaddy, John. Work for you?
Outstanding.
Yeah. So GoDaddy at GoDaddy.com, our first sponsor this week. This is where I go and have always gone to buy my domains. They make it easy to sort of consolidate everything together. They make it easy to manage your DNS. We used to run our own DNS server for Backup Server and Backbeat Media. We still do for some sort of ancillary things that we just have yet to transition over to GoDaddy. But man, I will tell you, managing your DNS with them, it just comes with your domain ownership, or at least it's come with every domain that I've ever gotten. And it's super fast, especially if you need to do an update. Like it used to be, and this is true, like if we were going to push an update to DNS structure on our stuff on our own server, it takes a little while to propagate. GoDaddy, I guess they must be, in fact, I'm certain they are, much closer to the source of everything. You push an update there, man, and it is like, boom, everybody in the world knows it. So, you know, and that's assuming you've got your time to live and all that stuff set right. But definitely a great place to buy domains. Like I said, I buy all of ours there. And, you know, we're constantly buying domains because we'll come up with ideas for things. And it's like, oh, all right, yeah, we should have that domain. We should have this one. And, you know, to have a coupon that gets you a discount on your domains is great. GoDaddy, they, you know, it seems like they pioneered internet coupons. If they didn't, it certainly looks that way. And we have one for you. MGG30 saves you 30% off of your new purchases. So when you have that brilliant idea about, oh, that's a domain, I want to go grab it, and then maybe I'll build a project on it later. You go do that. Use coupon code MGG30, saves you 30%. Your little flyer of an idea costs you a little bit less. So it's a little less of an investment, a little less of a risk. And GoDaddy allows us to give that to you. So go check it out. Go to GoDaddy.com and use coupon code MGG30. If you have any trouble, they've got 24/7 support, really dedicated to small business. They're the largest domain registrar. And again, really big savings. I think they have something like 13 million customers, which is crazy. So you know they're doing something right. So visit GoDaddy.com, use coupon code MGG30, and it saves you 30% off all new products. Our thanks to GoDaddy for sponsoring this episode. And with that, John, I think I want to go talk about Louis. Louis has a question that seems to come up quite a bit here, and so let's see where we can get. He wrote in, I'm not going to read the whole thing because it gets sort of convoluted, but he wrote in asking about memory. He's got 16 gigs of RAM on his late 2012 27-inch iMac, and he's constantly finding that his system is allocating a gig or 2 gigs worth of swap. Now, this is kind of normal. That's actually not something to worry about. I find because if you look in Activity Monitor or in iStat menus, you can see how much of that swap space it's actually using. And a gig is sort of the baseline of what it'll allocate. And it might only use a couple hundred megs of that. Using a little bit of swap makes sense. It's how the OS operates. So it's not a bad thing. Where I start to worry is if it's allocating 3 gigs or more of swap. That's sort of my baseline of you know, knowing that I'm hitting some RAM limits. And so I gave Louis this advice, and he went off with it, and he came back a couple days later and said, okay, so now I'm up at 3. And really, you know, when I look, it's Chrome that's eating all of my RAM. And the answer is, yeah, we know. And it's not just Chrome, it's Firefox, it's Safari, it's browsers. And it's not really browsers as much as it is web pages. Web pages have gotten really complex, and a lot of them, not all, but a lot of them tend to cause browsers to leak memory like a sieve. And it's because they've got so much like JavaScript and things going on. One of the worst offenders is Google Docs. And the, you know, any of those, like the iCloud, you know, the interactive pages stuff, any of that stuff that's happening in the browser, think about the, I mean, think about what you need to do to get Word to run on your Mac. That's a big program. Think about what it takes to get Excel to run on your Mac. That's a big program. Or Numbers or Pages, right? I mean, these are full-fledged programs. And now you're running those inside your browser. So, yes, it is going to consume a not insignificant amount of resources. And that's you know, that's just par for the course. Now, it doesn't mean you just want to let it leak and leave it alone. So you can actively manage it, closing tabs, especially those tabs that are, you know, Google Docs tabs, or you know, any of those kind of online editing tabs. Or you can do what I do, because I don't want to have to think about that. But I also know that I want to make sure I refresh at least my browser RAM no less than once a day. So I make sure my browser quits every night. And I do that with a cool little utility called Quitter from Marco Arment. We mentioned it before, but it's really cool. It monitors how long it's been since you've brought an app to the forefront. Or used it at all. It could be sitting in the forefront, but if you're not using it, that's okay. That kind of that lets the timer continue to tick. And you can set Quitter to either quit or, if you want, hide an app after X number of minutes of inactivity. So I have my browsers set to quit after, like, I don't know, I think it's 100 minutes on each of them. And that tends to be pretty good. You know, I don't want it quitting after 10 minutes of inactivity because it's kind of a pain in the neck. But you know, if I set it to 100, that's generally enough that it won't quit on me at the wrong time during the day, but will certainly quit overnight. And, you know, then when I come to my desk in the morning, I relaunch my browser. Of course, Safari is the one I use, and it refreshes all the tabs that I had open, so I really don't lose much. But I do get to start with at least a fresh RAM baseline before it starts opening all those tabs. And that tends to work really well for me. So that's how I do it. Any thoughts on this, John?
I would say I'm with you. So swap there. I'm looking at both of my machines here. So I see on the MacBook Pro, it says I'm using 435 megabytes out of 2 gigs. Okay. That I'll buy.
Yeah.
That's good. There's another aspect of memory measurement that we'll talk about shortly. So I won't mention that yet. And I think the other thing you want to look at is if you see a lot of page outs, especially if you see them happening like in real time.
Yeah.
That's a sign that your system is starting to have a problem dealing with memory, and it's going out to the hard drive.
Yeah, yeah.
So page ins are fine, but page outs are, I think, in general, viewed as something not good. And also, you'll see the swap, and I've noticed this. You'll see it ebb and flow. So if it gets really, there's the size of it, and then there's how much is being used.
Right.
You'll see that change over time, is that totally. They'll both get bigger and smaller depending on what you're running. So don't panic if they're big, because they should get smaller as you start quitting programs and not using a lot of memory.
Yep.
And I guess I kind of like your strategy, quitting the browser. I typically don't do that.
And Quitter is free, by the way.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, and I mean, it's totally handy. I couldn't live without it, to be honest.
The only other thing I'd mention is that plugins or add-ons to a browser, especially our friend Flash, and I have personally deinstalled Flash from both of my machines here. I've seen that cause a lot of grief, because not only being a security nightmare, but I think it can also run out of control.
Totally.
If Flash stuff is embedded in a web page.
Yeah, I actually find JavaScript more of a memory hog than Flash. I mean, there's other reasons to keep, you know, Flash well managed, but in terms of memory, I actually find the JavaScript pages or the HTML5 pages that have been built to replace Flash worse memory offenders than their previous Flash counterparts.
And the last thing that I've seen is that there are some pages. So there's one program that I run that's a plugin called Ghostery, mm-hmm. and it kind of shows you who's looking over your shoulder as far as tracking what you do and stuff like that.
Sure.
And I, in general, find that sites with more trackers and things that are watching or what you're doing tend to drag down performance. And also, I think eventually will consume memory. I mean, you've seen some of these pages, you know, these clickbait pages where it's like, oh, take this quiz and, you know, we'll guess where you're from and stuff.
Sure.
And the thing is, they throw up 100 ads. Literally, I've seen some pages that have 100 trackers and other things on them. And, and those will kill you. So try not to use those.
I mean, they might kill you. It depends on how efficiently they're run. I mean, a lot of those trackers, if it's just like an image or even a quick JavaScript, are actually extremely efficient. But they could. I mean, any resource that the web page loads could have a negative impact. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, some of those pages, I've gotten to the point where the page is like almost non-responsive because it's trying to do way too much.
Right. Right. Yeah. 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 For sure. For sure. A lot of that's less about the trackers and more about, you know, them trying to like have elements shifting while you scroll, and that sort of thing tends to really slow things down, especially on iOS. On the Mac, one of the things that I really like to do in Safari is I go into Preferences Security and I go to Plugins Settings, and I do leave Flash installed, but I don't let it run on most websites. So I leave Flash checked here. And then if you click on it, there's a little option down in the lower right that says when visiting other websites. And I set that to off. Don't set it to ask. Set it to off. And the reason for this is if it's set to ask, your computer will communicate to the other website or to the website, I have Flash. And so you'll see, you know, some level of like broken plugin sort of thing. And Safari will pester you and say, this website wants to use Flash. Do you want to allow it? Much better is if the website doesn't think you have Flash in the first place, because most websites these days will fall back, which should be really fall forward, to HTML5. So if you set this to off, websites will think you don't have Flash installed. And if they have a workaround, will display it for you. For the websites where you do want Flash to work, launch the website or load the website and then come here. You'll see in this same list, Preferences, Security, Plugin Settings, go to Flash. You'll see in this list currently open websites. It'll be set to off because that's your default, but you can change it here. So you can change it for on. Like for me, I know that the speed test site, and I know they've got an HTML5 version now, but the speed test site, I like to let it use Flash. Ticketmaster, I like to let it use Flash because I like to be able to, they have a little ticket picker or a seat picker that requires Flash. So I turn that on, and that's pretty much it. But if you've got other sites that you need Flash for, this is a perfect way to manage it because it's effectively like Flash is uninstalled for every other site except the ones you want to choose, and it can happen automatically. Hmm. It's really cool. Yeah, Brian wrote up a tip at Mac Observer about it, and we'll put that link in the show notes. Because
nice.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So you want
my solution?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, yeah.
My solution when something needs Flash is I run Chrome, which has Flash embedded in it. The Chrome browser.
Yeah, that's becoming less and less an option, though, right? I mean, they're doing the same thing. They're embedding it, but disabling it, right? I mean, it's effectively doing the same thing now. You kind of have to actively turn it on.
The last I ran it, no, I think it's always in there, but the last I ran Chrome for a site that needed Flash, it said, oh, yeah, by the way, the Flash plugin is out of date, so you better update it before I'm going to show you Flash content. So it's kind of self-aware.
Okay.
If you will. I mean, Safari does that, too. It kind of yells at you if Flash is out of date as well, the Flash plugin.
Yep.
But Chrome is another option. If you have infrequent needs to run Flash content, Chrome may be another way to go for you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that works. That works. You're right, because it keeps it up to date, whereas Safari does not. And the only time you know that your Flash is out of date is when you visit a site that invokes Flash, which if you use the method I just described, will be presumably very rarely. So you're almost always going to get the warning. Oh, you got to update. Okay, fine. You go to update. That's all fine and good, except when you got to buy tickets and the clock's ticking. So, you know, you want to talk about memory pressure now, John? I mean, because we're not going to revisit this topic. So if you want to talk about it, we can talk about it now. I find, in fact, let's talk about it. I find Apple's whole concept of memory pressure to be extremely unhelpful from a system management perspective. I don't know. It just doesn't seem it seems frankly, it seems stupid to me. And maybe I'm totally missing something, but
maybe. So first, people may be asking,
it's like typing
what
with
is,
mittens on. You don't really memory, get information from it.
So you got to ask yourself, what is memory pressure? And the way that Apple explains it, and I think they explain it best, at least their take on it, is they do have a support article that talks about Activity Monitor. And of course, Activity Monitor, one of the things it lets you view is memory pressure. And memory pressure, I think, is just a relative measure of how much work the system is doing, whether it be memory compression, which takes resources, you know, processing and things like that. It's giving you a relative measure of how much work is being done in order to manage memory. And the higher that number, the worse shape that you're in, is the best I can explain it. So it's a measure, but I think the metrics that we mentioned in the past are probably a better measure. The thing is, you should never see it. Or at least I'm looking at both of my machines, Dave, and my memory pressure is at 20%. And I think that's fine. But if you ever see it,
but what
getting,
does that mean? What is, I mean, what is 20%? I mean, can,
that's a great question because like I said, it's a relative measure. I'm not sure exactly what.
Yeah. That, okay. So
it's just saying 22 out of 100. It's like, okay, 22 out of 100.
But
is,
can it be worse than 100? I mean, if it's relative, how is there a ceiling? You get what I'm saying? Like because we've seen systems, you know, in our days get to the point where there's so much demand on the memory that the system is thrashing out to swap and you can't do anything. Like, is that 100 or would that be like 400 on Apple's scale? Like, can you run a system at 100? Because there is a point at which you will not be able to do a darn thing on that system. What's the memory pressure at that point? And I don't think you get that answer out of them. This is why I don't like memory pressure, because no one can answer this question. And here's the deal. I've asked Bud Tribble about this person to person, face to face.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, it's his team wrote this. So, you know, that's not such a bad thing. Great guy, great keyboard player. But he's like, well, he got all nebulous on me. It's like, Bud, why are you nebulous? Well, you know, and he didn't say this, but my interpretation of the way he answered was, this isn't really meant for people that care. It's meant for, and again, these are my words, not Bud's, but my interpretation, this is meant to be a very dumbed down, glossed over way of quickly seeing, am I in trouble? My opinion is a much better way to do that is to look at one number, and that is the amount of free RAM available. And if that number is under 100 megabytes, then you have a problem. And if you're running iStat menus, in order to see this correctly, you do have to make some changes. So go into iStat menus, go into memory, and two things. Uncheck the box that says show inactive memory is free, so that you're actually just seeing free memory, not inactive. And then change the display format from memory pressure to traditional. And then you can see the true amount of free RAM. Mm-hmm. And if that is less than 100 megabytes, then you need to quit some apps. You're going to get yourself into trouble. That's the best gauge. So that's it's my opinion.
Yeah. So it's a, we don't care about memory pressure. Don't even look at it. It's meaningless.
That's the thing, is it's meaningless to me, but maybe somebody's listening to this pounding their fist on their dashboard, and has an answer for us. So I'd be happy.
And if you are,
about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
And if you didn't hear what Dave said, because you're pounding on your dashboard, he said feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
No, it's definitely feedback at MacGeekGab.com. There's no question about it.
Yeah. That's right. I recommend shaking your fist rather than pounding on the dashboard, because you may break it. You know, cars are kind of fragile.
They can be, especially the dashboards. Yeah, that's right. Well, they're meant to absorb impact, not.
But no, I'm with you. They don't tell you what it's measuring. It's just a percentage.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of crazy. Oh, no. All right. Let's go to Elliot here. So Elliot has this to say. He says, I was amused to hear you, Dave, mention your interest in making the bill plus the tip come out to a palindromic total when you dine out. I have long done something very similar and thought I was the only one. No, Elliot, you're at least one of two. You're in a good club. We have jackets. We're crazy, but it's okay. He says, I challenge myself to make the dollars and cents come out to two consecutive numbers. Tonight, for example, the bill plus the tip came out to 88.89. This is certainly an interesting cerebral exercise, but there is an added advantage to it. There are some worries that when an unscrupulous restaurant runs your credit card, they may pad the bill later. The way I do it and the way you do it, when I get my credit card bill, I can easily check to see if all of the restaurant totals are indeed fitting my little formula. So far, fortunately, I have not come up with any fraud detection alerts in this manner, and I hope it continues to be the case. But still, I enjoy doing the exercise, and most of the people with whom I eat out are amused by this little idiosyncrasy of mine. So, yeah, I didn't even think about it from that standpoint, but there is something that I do for that very reason, and it's when I buy gasoline at the pump. I have it end every time in the same digit, and that digit is not zero. It didn't start out to be a fraud detection thing, but it certainly has worked out to be.
Don't do that, man.
You're not
supposed to do that.
Why not?
You're not supposed to top off.
Well, I don't top off. I just round up. I mean, it's 9 cents or less of worth of gas that I'm adding to the total to get that. The cents to end in my magic number. That's all. See what I'm saying? I'm not like, you know, adding dollars worth of gas to my tank. And we're not even going to talk about whether topping off is good or not. But
They recommend against it.
I know.
If you read the label on the pump. Because it emits, you know, garbage in the air.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's non-recoverable stuff that...
Adding nine cents or less worth of gas just to get it to that point. And I think I started doing it because... So I see so many people with credit cards, you know, paying with a credit card and rounding up to, you know, a whole dollar amount. And it's like, I totally get why you do that with cash and why we all got in that habit. But with a credit card, it doesn't actually matter because you're not doing any change or anything. It's just whatever the number is. That's what they charge you for. So I think I started doing it for that reason. And then it's really handy because when I go through my credit card bill, it's like, boop, 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 boop. Okay. Yep. Those gas charges are great. Totally makes sense.
Okay. So. I'm sure just you doing it will not destroy the planet, but if everybody does it...
We're talking 9 cents or less worth of gas. This is not the same as topping off, John.
I understand.
Okay.
Every little bit.
Okay. I'm not doing it, John. Irv writes, with numbers 405, it appears that files can no longer be sent directly via email... while including a conversion to Excel. You seemingly can share a .numbers file with a friend, but there is no file type conversion during the sharing process. You can export to Excel and then manually attach the Excel file to an email and send it, but the older ability of emailing directly from numbers with an on-the-fly conversion to Excel and pasting the converted file into an email was so much easier. Am I missing something? Why would Apple take away such a nice feature? I think they did... take this out. I do recall having it, and I don't seem to be able to do it now. So, yes, it's gone. This actually came up in conversation this week, not this specifically, but somebody was getting numbers files emailed to them. A friend was who's a Windows guy. And he asked me how can I convert these things now that I have them? He doesn't have numbers for Windows. And I think Zamzar is your friend, as always. And that's Zamzar.com. I think this might be the very first cool stuff found we ever shared on the show. It's certainly one of the earlier ones. And you can go to Zamzar and you upload your file to them. So you have to be okay, you know, sharing these files outward like this with a conversion service. But you tell it what you want to convert the files to. And it will take numbers files. It will convert to numbers files if you choose. And then you put your email address in and it sends you the converted file. So very fun stuff. So if you do wind up or, you know, if your non-Mac using friends wind up with a numbers file that they need to convert, or you wind up, well, I was going to say numbers will convert Excel files, but Zamzar is pretty good. It can convert from a lot of different formats, including some sort of ancient formats that are no longer, you know, unspoken languages, if you will. So Zamzar, Zamzar.com, one of my favorite little utilities. Don't use it often, but I sure use it when I sure like it when I need it. Remember Zamzar, John?
Yeah. Sounds like an old cartoon. Like a superhero. Zamzar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Very cool stuff. All right. Moving on to Andrew here. Andrew writes. Oh, where is it here? He says, he's got a tip here. He says, okay, yeah. In the dark days of Windows, one of the only cool things that you could do to get a clickable file, was that you could get a clickable file path link to a file. This was handy at work when someone in another location wanted to share a file with you by simply copying the file path and dropping it in an email. I struggled to get this on the Mac. Why did I want it? Well, I use Evernote. I have some text in a note and I wanted to put a link to a pages file for reference at the bottom of that note, but I ran into problems. And he can copy the path, but he can't do it in a linkable way. He found that signing into iCloud.com, he could get an iCloud link to the file, but that's not perfect unless he uses a note and all of that. One easy way to do this is to copy the link to the file and then put copy the URL to the file and then put file:// in there. In the beginning of it, like you would a web page with http://, and that will get you to the file. Have you had luck with that, John?
Yeah, if you know from the Finder, if you know that doing option copy will copy the path name of a file, then that gives you
most
of what you need. Sorry,
thank you for that. I missed that. That's right. Yeah, option copy. That's right. Yeah,
but it doesn't give you everything. It's like so close. And I think you may have to, last I played with this, I think you may have to, if there are spaces and all that, I'm not sure if it takes care of this, but you may have to put special encoding. I think it's what, %20? Or I think that may happen if you use this.
I think it does happen if you use that. Yeah.
Okay. And if you see that, that's what it's doing. So %20 is the hex code for a space, right?
Right. That's 32. Right. That's right. Yeah, you're right. That's a hex code. Oh, yeah. Yeah, fun stuff. I was, you'll appreciate this, John, little tangential detour, but hanging out with the Dallas Apple Mug folks, or whatever it's called. It's not the Apple Mug. They are an Apple user group in every sense. But they started in 1978. They're going to have their 40th anniversary next January. So they are
78. That's like Apple II, man.
Exactly. It is. That's what I'm saying is it's an Apple user group. It's not a Mac user group. I mean, it is now, in a sense, but they also talk about, iOS and all of that stuff. But yeah, their group predates the Mac by 6 years, which is pretty cool. and there's some people there that have, old stuff. Like they've got a prototype 2C+. They've got some original, several original Apple ones that the people, people in the group have, and then all kinds of.
Oh, wow. Yeah. How about have you ever seen, I think I saw this once in a prior life, a black Apple II?
I don't know if one of them has a black Apple II, but yeah, I have seen, pictures of those. That's
trying to
cool.
remember, but I think they partnered with another. Trying to find here. Yeah, they partnered with another company that I think they.
Yep.
It was an Apple II, but it was black instead of beige.
That's so cool. That's so cool.
Yeah, Bell and Howell here. I think it was Bell and Howell.
Really?
Yeah, I'm looking here in the history. The Apple II Plus was also sold by Bell and Howell specifically to education markets under a special license. I think that was the one. Yep. Except it came in a black case. Okay. Blast from the past.
Yeah. 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 And a lot of them have 2GSs and stuff that they run, you know, I mean, just for fun. But we were talking, those were, you know, that was a good machine to learn on because you could turn on the Apple II and within, you know, 10 minutes or less, because it had a basic interpreter right there, you could write some code and make that machine like do your bidding immediately. Try to do that with a Mac. You know, it's going to take a long time to get to the point where you can do that. And I'm not saying that obviously the Mac is more capable and more powerful than the Apple II was, but in terms of sort of enticing, new people to the novices, enticing those people, you know, that class of user to go deeper, the Apple II was brilliant for that. And the Mac really isn't.
Which they had mini. I remember the mini assembler, so you could actually do some 6502 assembly. Yep. What else was fun? Oh, I remember fondly. So I believe it was if you shorted pins 26 and 29 on the connector, it would generate a non-maskable interrupt, which was something handy if you wanted to, shall I say, liberate some software.
Oh, yeah, for people that were trying to break the copy protection on software. Yeah.
I don't like that term. Liberate.
Right. Right. Well, there you go. That's
but
right.
It would make something happen on the machine that forced it to run code that you loaded previously that would make that job a little easier.
Very cool.
Had to be careful you didn't short the wrong pins, though, because then you destroy your machine.
Right, but you could probably just solder something to them and then build a button to do NMIs, right?
And I think a lot of the cards that help you do that, that's essentially what they did, and they had like a little button, you know, like a little button that you'd press. And, yep. And once you press the button, it would then run the code on the card, and it would help you out.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes. Yeah, it was fun stuff. Anyway, it was good talking to these people. I love going to these user groups. It's especially the ones that really, you know, put some effort in, and it's clear the folks in Dallas do. And they're not the only ones. I mean, I have the pleasure of speaking at many of them. I'm going to be at Houston. I think I've got to work out a date with Houston, but I'm going to be probably at Houston later this year if we can find the date. I'm going to be at Philadelphia and also Princeton. And maybe one other that I'm talking with. So it should be, it's always fun. Like I said, going to meet with these groups. It's always a fun 24 hours. You know, you get into town and we had some great barbecue and then we went and did the thing. And like I said, we probably chatted for about routers for 3 hours. So it was pretty good. All right. Let's go to Mike here. We've got a little bit of time left. Mike asks, my car has an aftermarket add-on that connects my old pre-Lightning connector iPod to the buttons on the car radio, allowing me to use the radio's control buttons to control the iPod. Skip track, browse playlist, artist song, etc. I use it mainly to listen to podcasts while driving. If no podcasts, then music. Periodically, I Wi-Fi sync the iPod, which is resting in the center console of my car in the garage, to my MacBook Pro for any new downloaded unplayed podcasts. I use a smart group to control which podcast should be pushed. Sometimes I get behind schedule and there are hours of podcasts waiting to be heard on the device. When I sync the device in iTunes, it always makes a backup. And sometimes this backup takes a long time over Wi-Fi. Is there a way to bypass the backup in iTunes during a sync? There is nothing on the iPod that I can't recreate from scratch if necessary. No photos, no apps, no nothing. I don't need a backup of all the podcasts / music that are on the device. I just want iTunes to read the played state from the device, update the smart group in the MacBook, and then push anything new back out. So this is a great question. And yes, you can disable backups, but it's a universal setting for iTunes, not a per device setting, near as I can tell. And the way you do it is you have to go into the terminal, and we'll put an article in the show notes so you don't have to think, you don't have to remember this. But it's one of those defaults write commands. So it's default space write space com.apple.itunes space device backups disabled - bool true. And again, we'll put this in the show notes so that you don't have to think about it. But that's how you can turn these backups off. The other way is to set your device to back up to iCloud, and then it won't auto back up to iTunes even when you sync over Wi-Fi or USB. But if you don't want to also be backing up, or if you don't want to instead be backing up to iCloud, if you just don't want to be backing up at all, then leave it as an iTunes backup, but turn this I guess you're turning this flag to true, which disables the backups. Always good stuff. Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
That's how I'm set up for iCloud. And yeah, I'll add one last thing here. There may be, I'm not sure, depending on your needs, but you may not even want to sync devices.
Oh, sure.
In, Dave.
Sure.
And I'll just give a quick tip here. If you want to set that, now that you don't have to dig in the terminal. Actually, you can do that through iTunes. If you go to iTunes, Preferences, Devices, you're going to see a little checkbox that says prevent iPods, iPhones, and iPads from syncing automatically. There you go.
There you go.
Yep. I don't know why you'd want to, but maybe for similar reasons. You know, you don't want
dude,
all that data.
I turn that off, or I check that box on mine, because sometimes
really?
I just, yeah, because okay. I like on this machine earlier, I plugged in my phone to charge. Now, I did it so we could test that battery percentage utility, but other times I just plug it in. While I'm podcasting and doing stuff, I don't want iTunes just launching simply because I plugged my phone in, and that prevents that from happening. And you can prevent, while we're at it, bonus tips, you can prevent photos from launching by, you have to let it auto launch once when you plug in your device or have it launched prior, but then click on your device in Photos. And when you do, up at the top of the screen will be a little box. Uncheck it. I think the box says something along the lines of, automatically open photos for this device. It'll be very clear. I just don't want to open photos because I'm podcasting right now. But uncheck that. And then Photos won't auto launch in the background either. And of course, these settings, you don't have to set both of them. So if you want iTunes to sync or if you want Photos to sync, but not the other, you know, just do one versus the other. So, yeah. I like being able to do that. And I think, yeah, in the stream here at MacGeekUp.com/stream in the chat room, Brian Monroe, Alex is saying that you can set that with image capture too. And I seem to recall that. So, you can do it in one place or the other. All right. What else do we have, John? Let's see. We want to talk about, you want to talk about this Mac Mini thing from David here?
Yeah. It's going to be an ongoing saga here, but something to address.
Okay.
So he says, I have a Mac Mini 7.1 late 2014 and checked MacSales.com and pretty much I'm screwed. Well, you're not, but there are no memory or HDD updates they recommend. I'd like to speed this machine up, and since I'm pretty much locked out of any sort of upgrade, I was wondering if I purchased an external SSD and booted to it via USB 3, if that's an option.
Huh.
Would I get any benefit in doing so versus internal hard disk drive? I've done the SSD upgrade in older machines before, and it's worked wonders, but with zero options on the Mac Mini, this was all I could think of. Any thoughts on this before I start experimenting? A number of thoughts. So one, as you may know, this is the machine that I have, Dave.
Right.
And I think as you also recall, I upgraded the crummy rotational hard drive that Apple put in there when I bought it. And I was fully aware of this, and this was my intent. I pulled that crummy hard drive out. I use it for doing a backup because speed is not a concern when I'm doing a backup at 2 in the morning or whenever. And I replaced it with I think it's a Crucial 1 terabyte SSD. Wonderful. SATA 3. But then I'm scratching my head, Dave, kind of like we did in the last episode. And I'm like, why would Mac Sales, I wouldn't say they're lying, but why would they not say that you could upgrade the hard drive in this machine when clearly you can? And if you go to iFixit, you'll see, and that's where I actually went to get the instructions for taking this thing apart. It's a challenge. The Mac Mini, they don't make, I would say the 2014, it's easier to get in there and replace things. It's a better design than at least the 2010 that I had. That one was you could actually disconnect key components when you were sliding out the motherboard. Not so in the 2014. I think the 2014 is nice to work on. The only caveat with the 2014 is you need a special TR6 screwdriver. It's a security Torx. That was the only thing.
Okay.
So you take off the bottom cover, and then I looked at the screws, and I'm like, oh, that's a T6. And then I took my T6, and I'm like, it doesn't fit because there's a hole in the middle of a security Torx. So you got to, I ordered it, I think, from iFixit, where I ordered a special screwdriver, and I think it's in some of their latest kits. So I went to them. I actually went to their site, Dave, and I chatted with one of the representatives. And I'm like, I didn't say you're but I'm like, why are you not saying that you can upgrade this machine? And they have an upgrade feature on their site where you say, this is my machine. And they'll tell you, here's all the things available. And they don't say that a hard drive upgrade is available. I'm like, well, why is that, guys? And they gave me a good answer. And I'll go with them on this. This machine came in various configurations. So it has two ports. So it has a SATA 3 port for the rotational hard drive, which is what I ordered. But it also has an eSATA, as far as I can tell, kind of proprietary connector in there. So if you order it either solely with an SSD or a Fusion drive, that slot is going to have the SSD and the... So I guess the answer is there's no guarantee that it's going to have the bracket or... Right. And it's pretty much a bracket.
Right.
For you to put in a 2.5-inch SATA 3 SSD.
That makes sense. So can you buy that bracket or like if it didn't come with it, no, you shall not have one.
From what I've seen, there are discussion threads on iFixit talking about this. So you can either get an adapter that makes their eSATA connector friendlier for installing a third-party upgrade, or you can buy the bracket. It's a plastic bracket. And then if you get that bracket, then you can put in a standard 2.5-inch SATA 3 SSD.
Got it. So I this is now it makes sense, of course, why they choose to give the advice that they give, because it's nebulous, right? Although they could get a little more detailed if they chose. I want to answer.
Say did your machine right. come with a 2.5-inch rotational drive? And if it did, then the answer is yes, you can add an SSD to this machine. No question about it, because I've done it.
I want to rewind a little and answer David's first question, which is, would it work and would I see any benefit? Of course it would work, to plug in an SSD via USB 3. And my answer to that question is going to be absolutely yes. In fact, you would see most, if not all, of the benefit for you of the SSD by plugging it in USB 3. Most of the benefit is going to come from the latency reduction that you get with the SSD, and that'll work even over like USB 2. You'll see that because it has nothing to do with transfer speed. It just has to do with data access speed. So when I've done this before with USB 2, I've seen huge like timing increases or timing decreases in terms of like boot times and application launch times and all of that stuff, because most of that has nothing to do with the amount of data. It has to do with the drive seeking to find it and then loading it. So even though the interface with USB 2 is much slower than whatever I have inside the computer, the access of the SSD kind of sort of trumps that. But with USB 3, then you're getting even faster.
Right.
I think for a lot of people, I think doing, for a fixed machine, obviously not for a portable machine like a MacBook, but for a fixed machine, there's less and less reason to crack it open with USB 3
right
on the outside.
Now, if you see his follow-up to my suggestion.
Yep.
So I answered in kind. I said SSD and a USB 3 enclosure is the easiest option.
Totally.
To go in the machine.
Yeah.
He got back to us and we have to analyze this, but he said he did this and it was a disaster. The machine, number one, he wasn't able, and I don't know if it's because he's running El Capitan. I don't know if it's because he's running that, but he indicated that he couldn't see the drive as a bootable option with the startup manager, which is if you hold down option when you boot your Mac, it'll show you the bootable devices.
Oh.
So he said, I didn't see that. And that's weird because I verified on my machine that my backup drive shows up.
So you're not, okay. So it might
but
be,
he also said,
well, it might be, I mean, if you get an external drive and it comes formatted as a Windows drive, then you would not be able to boot from it. You would have to reformat it as GUID and all of that. So that might be the reason.
And also he said, but it sounds like he made a clone and was kicking the tires on this idea. And also he said that it took like 10 minutes to start up, which that's certainly not my experience. Even with a rotational drive in a USB 3 enclosure on this machine, Dave, it took me maybe 3 minutes to boot.
Okay.
And this is a kind of a slow drive here. So there's something else going on. But my answer was the same as yours. And he indicated, and we'll have to dig in further and follow up on this. He indicated that it appeared to not be a valid option. And like you said, especially with USB 3 where you got 5 gigabits, that's not a bottleneck.
Nope.
I'd argue that USB 2 at 480 megabits.
Well, it's a speed bottleneck, but so little of what we all do actually matters. The speed matters. It affects us very, very little in that regard, to be perfectly honest. I mean, just based on tests, you know, most of us are loading very small files and lots of them. So you're never actually hitting those speed walls. But yeah, check the format for HFS Plus. And I'm actually reading here in our chat room because Alex has a lot of these answers. But check the format for HFS Plus. And also he says, go to the terminal and check out, if you want to get geeky about it, check out the bless command. So it's man to get information, documentation on the command, man space bless. Bless is the command that lets you tell a drive that it is now bootable. So it should happen automatically, but depending on how he's doing the clone and all of that, it may or may not be. So blessing the drive, sort of forcing it to be blessed as a bootable drive might also help. So there you go.
So we may help you figure that out, David, but it sounds like he's going to roll up his sleeves and crack that thing open and pop in the SSD, and then you're going to be just blazing along.
That's right. Yeah. Fun stuff. I like all this stuff anyway. It's good. All right. I think we have, we might have time for one more here. Let's, it's a bit of a geek challenge, perhaps. We have sort of half an answer for Kevin. Kevin asked, he says, I'm a little embarrassed. I've held back on updating my OS because I really don't like the new style, the way it looks, especially the icons. So I'm still back on Mavericks, the last version before they changed the style with the flat icons. But I know that I need to move forward. He says, and I know that I can change the icons one at a time. Is there a way to apply changes globally? For example, the icon for a folder when you create a new folder, or the icon that appears on your desktop when you mount an external drive. Is there any way to change these defaults? So I've looked. It doesn't seem like anyone has written a utility that does this. There used to be utilities, certainly in like the pre-OS 10 days, that would, you know, let you change all your icons. And I feel like there might have been some even in the, you know, the post-OS 10 days or the inter-OS 10 days. I couldn't find one. I did, however, find a YouTube video that explains how to do this. Essentially what you're going to do, and we'll of course put a link to this video, but essentially what you're going to do is go into the system library and start changing the icons inside a file there. The video, as it should, advises you to make a copy of this package, because if you totally FUBAR things, you know, you just put the original back and then everything works. But that's as good as I could find to do this. And so the geek challenge of this would be, does anyone know of a utility that would, or just a way of making this happen a whole lot easier? I can see why people would want it. I mean, that's kind of a nice thing to be able to, you know, tweak your defaults and all of that. But we'll see. We'll see. Yes. So fun stuff, though. It's
I do have an answer.
Yeah,
go
ahead.
At least a very quick answer.
Sure.
Well, my way, the thing is, those icons have to be stored somewhere, Dave.
Right. They're stored in that file. Yeah.
And you may ask yourself, not only how do I work this, but you may ask yourself, sorry, where is that data stored? And I just found a dandy little article from OS X Daily, and they tell us where. And it's actually buried deep within the system. There's a file that has all the icons. So you could, if you can get a icon editor, and I don't know if I would think Xcode would probably let you do this, but that would be the way to do it. It would make me kind of nervous, though.
Well, this is what this is exactly what I just said.
Yeah.
This YouTube video gets you there.
Oh, okay.
And so shows
gives,
you how to
it
do it.
It gives this path.
It gives this path. Okay. Yeah. But you have to go in
library, course services, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It's a bundle somewhere.
Yeah. And you dig into it and you change, you have to change each of the sizes of, you know, every icon comes in a million different sizes. And doing it this way, you have to change each of them individually. So it starts to get a little tedious, but I think there's like eight per something. So if you want to do a folder, default folders, you not the app default folder, but if you want to change the default folder icon, then you have to just change all eight of those or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if the OS would be very happy with you, especially with system integrity protection. I mean, that's like hacking the OS, dude, right?
Yeah, well, and your changes would be blown away, presumably, with any type of OS update, or could be blown away. It depends on if this file is impacted, but even a minor point update could, revert all this back. So, yeah, if there's a third-party utility, that would be a much better way, but I if there is one, they've done a terrible job of surfacing it with Google, and no one's talking about it, so it's not so good. But it would be nice to find. You can change individual icons, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's just copy and paste.
What you do is you find the folder or even the file or the disk that you want to change the icon, do a get info on it in the Finder, file, get info, or command I. And then in the upper left-hand corner, click on the icon. You can copy or paste here. So if you copy the icon from something you like, you can paste it to something else, and then they will both have the same icon. And conversely, you can take... you try it with lots of different graphics. I've been able to put things in there, and you just paste it in, and then it changes the icon for you. So that's handy. At least you can do that. But as Kevin pointed out, that gets a little tedious when every new folder you make, you want to have a different icon. I guess you could probably script that with Keyboard Maestro. All right. Put something on the clipboard, paste the icon in. So instead of doing command N, command shift N in the Finder to make a new folder, you could do a different keystroke and have Keyboard Maestro make the folder, do the get info, paste the thing in. I mean, that would be possible. Apple Script maybe as well.
Or just deal with it. Nah.
Or just deal with it. Right. Right. I mean, right. There's always that. Yeah. But it's fun to customize. So I already told you how to email us unless you are a premium listener. And we would love to have you as a premium listener because all premium listeners are able to access our premium at MacGeekGab.com address. That's available for all of you that are active premium members. And we do answer those questions first. We give them a priority. Most weeks we get to all the questions, at least behind the scenes, if not here in the show. Certainly not here in the show. But behind the scenes we try to get to everything. But of course, those of you that help us keep the lights on, we prioritize what you send in. And we're happy to do it. We're happy to have you. And we're happy to have all of you. So if you don't want to contribute via the premium stuff, you don't have to, and that's totally fine. But if you do, visit MacGeekGab.com and you'll see a link right there that'll bring you right to it. Any of you can call our voicemail number, and that voicemail number, John, is 224-888-GEEK. GEEK stands for
4-3-3-5.
And come visit our great community on Facebook. Visit us at MacGeekGab.com/Facebook. We have several posts a day, and with many, many smart people answering questions, helping each other. It's just a great little community. I love it. It's a wonderful little thing, and I appreciate everybody that takes part in it. And we're getting close to 2,000 members in that community. So come and join us there. MacGeekGab.com/Facebook. Of course, I want to thank Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for providing all the bandwidth that gets the show from us to you. And of course, our sponsors, as we mentioned, GoDaddy earlier. Coupon code MGG30 saves you 30%. Fat Cat Software at fatcatsoftware.com/MGG. Smile at smilesoftware.com/geek. Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com. Barebones Software at barebones.com. And Blue Apron at blueapron.com/MGG, where you can get your first three meals for free. We're cooking one of those tonight, as far as I know. I'm looking forward to it. It's always fun. Thanks for hanging out with us, folks. Have a splendid week. For those of you like us dealing with the blizzards, don't get caught.
Made up.